the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
We're going to begin just by watching a little clip from a very well-known film called Schindler's List. You may know this film. In this scene, Oskar Schindler, who was an industrialist, has managed to save the lives of countless Jewish workers in his factory during the Second World War, basically by bribing the owner of the concentration camp, the commander of the concentration camp. And this scene is right at the end of the movie where he's being thanked by some of his Jewish workers. Thanks, Guy. Bear that in mind. We will come back to that later on. If you still have Luke 16 open in front of you, page 991, that's going to be very helpful. This is a puzzling parable, I think, Luke 16. It's unique to Luke's gospel, and we know that's within the sovereignty of God. Humanly speaking, one reason why it may be unique to Luke's gospel is because it wasn't one of Jesus' better-known parables. And that may be because it was one of his less popular parables, because it is, in some ways, quite a confusing parable. But I think it's a phenomenally powerful one when we get our heads around what I think Jesus is teaching. So three things quickly this morning before we finish. And the first is this. If we're thinking about, as we are in this series, what a follower of Jesus, a disciple, is, and John has helped us so fully with that last week particularly, then one of the truths about a disciple is to do with the way they handle money. And one of the things this little story Jesus tells is this: a disciple is a manager of God's money. We're sometimes confused in this parable, aren't we, by the manager's dishonesty. And he's actually very dishonest. He's dishonest twice. He's dishonest at the start because he's just very careless with his boss's money. The word that's used for wasting is the same word that's used in chapter 15 for the way the prodigal son squanders his dad's money. And the word literally in the Greek meant scattering, just throwing it around like it meant nothing, wasn't valuable. Interestingly, the same kind of word that Schindler uses in that clip for the way he's used his money. He said, I've wasted so much. That's what this manager had been doing. And he's dishonest not just once, but he's dishonest twice. So when he's got that little window where he's still in charge of his boss's money, what he does at that moment isn't particularly honest with somebody else's money either. But let's just be clear, he's not being commended for his dishonesty. His dishonesty is what gets him the sack. There's no indication he's going to keep his job after this little episode either. It's his dishonesty that's got him the sack. And Jesus, in verses 10 to 12, if you want to cast your eyes over those again, makes it very, very clear what he thinks of dishonesty. So whatever is being commended here, it's not being dishonest. But I think the big truth, one of the big truths of this passage is this. Jesus just wants us to be clear that a disciple is a manager of God's money. And I think that's why the hero, the central character of this story, is a manager. He doesn't himself own wealth. He manages somebody else's wealth. So the money that he has at his disposal is not his. The fact that in verse 4 he's worried about where he's going to sleep after this may even indicate that the house he's living in comes with the job. Even the house he has, the roof over his head, isn't his. That's his master's as well. Everything this guy has isn't actually his. It's his master's. And that's why I think Jesus has crafted this brilliant little story this way, because that's our situation too. Everybody in the room, I would go as far as say everybody in the world, this is true of. What we have is not ours. It's God's. Everything, our time, our money, our houses, our children, our parents, our families, our cars, our educations, our jobs, our very lives. None of what we have is actually ours. All of it ultimately belongs to God. He's just asked us to manage it for a while. All this beautiful stuff he's put in our lives, he's just asked us to be the managers of it for a while. And you could argue that the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian is actually that they've understood that fact and they are living in the light of it. Do you remember when folks are following Jesus around saying, "Lord, Lord," and Jesus says to them, "Why do you call me Lord when you don't do what I say?" I think a Christian is somebody who has recognized that They possess, they own, they have the right to nothing in their lives. They have a lord who is over them, a boss, a master. And whatever they do have control of in their lives, in our lives, is given to us by our master. We're just managers of it. Recently, Penny and I invested a little bit of money for our retirement. And the bank we chose to invest it with was the Cooperative Bank, and one of their unit trust funds. And what the co-op do when you invest money with them is they send you a photograph, a little brochure, and in it there is a photograph of the individual and their name who is managing your money. So we invested our money in a little trust fund, and you get a photograph of and the name of the woman who is in charge of managing our money. So our money has been given to her, and she's now in control of how it's used, and she'll be held to account for how it's used. And I think that's actually a fantastic picture of our lives. We are kind of trust managers of time and money and opportunity and children perhaps, and perhaps a spouse and a job and perhaps a home and perhaps a car. And we're trust managers of all these things that actually belong to God, but he's given us the responsibility just for a little while of managing. And it might just be just pausing for a moment and just checking that we agree, if we're claiming to be followers of Jesus, that we actually agree with that statement. Because when I got a grip of that, and it was a little bit after I became a Christian actually, that this truth dawned on me, that kind of revolutionized the way I thought about all kinds of areas of my life. Daryl Bock, in his commentary on Luke's Gospel, says this: to possess money is to hold a sacred stewardship. To possess money is to hold a sacred stewardship. Do you really believe that you are the servant of a master and that nothing you have is really yours, but actually it's really all his? That you're a trust manager for God, and the trust is your life and everything in it, including your money. And I think that's why money becomes such a key indicator of discipleship in the New Testament. Do you remember Jesus saying, where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be also. Where your money is, that's actually where your heart is. So Jesus says, you want to know what somebody really cares about? You want to know really what gets them up in the morning, what gives them passion and drive? You want to know what that is? Find out where their money is. Because their money, their treasure, is going to be a key indicator of what they really, really care about, what their main priority actually is. And some of Jesus' hearers, the Pharisees, verse 14 of chapter 16, just couldn't take that. They sneered at Jesus, Luke tells us, when he said that. And it might just be worth giving ourselves a little MOT on that one this morning. Is that our perspective on all the stuff that comes into our lives? Or are we actually saying, well, most of it's mine, but I'm going to give a little bit of it to God, but actually most of it is mine. God gets a bit, but the rest is all mine. I think the New Testament turns that on its head and says, no, everything is God's. We're just managers of this incredible stuff that he gives us. And that's why I think the hero of this story is a manager, not the master, but actually the manager, because that's the situation we're in. And the choice this guy has is the same choice that you and I have every day of our lives. Oh, what are we going to do with our master's stuff that he's entrusted to us? Are we going to squander what he's given to us? Or are we going to use it in much, much better ways? Second big truth is this. Disciples can either squander God's money or, and here's the phrase that we're going to spend a little bit of time thinking about, they can use it to make friends in heaven. Now, as we said, the manager's commended, not for his dishonesty, but what he does with his master's stuff in verses 5 to 7. So if you could just cast your eyes down Luke 16, verses 5 to 7 again. He has a brief few moments between being fired and leaving the building with his personal belongings in a cardboard box. And he's just got a brief few moments to clear his desk and get out the building. And in those brief few moments, he is still in charge of his master's stuff. Now, what is he going to do with it? And with a guy who we know is dishonest, we could, I guess what we're expecting to happen is this. He's going to fill his pockets with the petty cash, and he's going to open the drawers and nick all the staples, and he's going to go to the cupboard and pull out all the sachets of coffee, and he's going to just nick as much as he can, and just leave the office. And the sting in the tail of this beautiful little story is that that's not what he does. He does something much sharper. He uses his control of his boss's resources for the last few moments he has control over it to win himself friends. He uses his boss's money in ways that are going to benefit him relationally. He changes other people's lives by the way he uses his boss's money. The oil bill that's in verse 6, 3,000 litres of olive oil, apparently that was about 5 years' salary for an average working person in the day. That's half of that, 2.5 years' salary. That's a pretty generous gift that he's just made them, isn't it? The wheat that's mentioned in verse 7, that was about 12 years' salary, worth 12 years' salary. These are huge amounts that he is in control of, and he's making these extremely generous gifts with his boss's money to his boss's debtors. Here's the principle, I think. He uses something that isn't his, that he won't have for long, to make such a difference in other people's lives that they will love him forever. Let me just read that again. This is the principle, I think, of the parable of the shrewd manager. He uses something that isn't his, and that he won't have for long, to make such a difference in other people's lives that they will love him forever. And that's the chance we have got as trust managers with everything that God has temporarily, just for a very short period of time, has given to us. A few years ago, we had a young man with us here at Belmont just for a year. We'll call him John. That wasn't his name, for reasons you'll see later on. But we'll call him John. He was a post-doctorate expert in Arabic. And he was doing some post-doctoral studies at the university in the School of Arab and Islamic Studies. He was an Irishman. And John's long-term goal was to get out to the Middle East and to work in a Muslim nation as a tent-making missionary. And he'd already spent, as you might imagine with a PhD in Arabic, he'd already spent a lot of time out in the Middle East, in Muslim countries. And he was having experiences like this all the time. He would tell stories like, he would be in a cafe in a Muslim country, and the owner of the cafe would say to him, as he ordered his drink, he would say to him, you're a Westerner, aren't you? And he'd say, yeah, I'm from Ireland. And he'd say, do you know Jesus? The Muslim cafe owner would ask John, do you know Jesus? And John would say, yeah, I know Jesus. The cafe owner would push all the other customers out of the cafe, lock the door, pull the blinds down, sit John down, and say this to him. This actually happened to him. The cafe owner said, I need you to tell me about Jesus, because last night Jesus appeared to me in a dream and told me when I died he was going to judge me. So I need to know what to do. He was having those experiences a lot, just that one-on-one, quiet friendship evangelism in a Muslim country. So John was over here for a year worshipping with us, studying at the university, before going back out to the Middle East. And he came to us as leadership team and said, I would love to take a team from Belmont out to Syria and just do some low-level prayer and friendship evangelism, just get a little team, maybe 6-8 people, used to just to living in a Muslim land for a while and experiencing what life is like and praying for the Middle East and just meeting some Syrian Christians and also some Muslims. How does that sound? And we said, that sounds great. And he put the whole thing together and he pitched it on a Sunday evening from here. And at the end of that service, somebody came to me and said, one of our congregation, who's still here, came to me and said, I would love to go on that trip, but I just can't. Can't get the time off work. Annual leave used up. Can't do it. And he pulled out his checkbook, and there and then he just wrote a check for the amount of money it would take to get somebody out there and back, and said, I want to pay for somebody else to go. And that happened. His money paid for a student to go who wouldn't have been able to afford it themselves. Now let's just go forward. This now is just imagination. Let's just imagine the next this happens. Can you imagine this? Let's imagine that student goes on John's trip, catches a vision for evangelizing Muslims, comes back from that short-term trip, finishes their degree, trains to teach English as a foreign language, with the specific intent of going back to the Middle East as a tent-making, English teaching, friendship evangelist. Does that? And is it, let's imagine they're out there now, and they are teaching English as a foreign language in Muslim countries, and they are befriending Muslims, and they are sharing Christ with them, and Muslims are becoming Christians through them, and the families of Muslims are becoming Christians through them, and friends are becoming, and there's a whole ripple effect that comes when people become Christians. Imagine that's happening. Now let's imagine this. Our congregation member from Belmont who pulled out the checkbook and wrote the check. Imagine this. They die and go to glory. And when they are in heaven, they are surrounded by Muslim converts. They're surrounded by people who were Muslims who become Christians, and they are thanking him for the way he used his money. Because in God's sovereignty, that check was used to send a student out who called a vision for evangelization of the Muslim world, who did it faithfully and regularly, and who knows what the impact of that life could be. And when our friend who wrote the check gets to glory, he finds that he's turned money that is temporary, that isn't ours anyway, that we only have for a little window, and rather than squandering it on nonsense, he's done something remarkable with it that has won him friends in glory. That, I think, is the point of the parable of the shrewd manager. We have this incredible privilege of being trusted with God's resources. How are we going to use them? What could we do for eternity with the money that God puts into our lives? Now, I know that many people in this room have had this principle embedded in their hearts and their minds for years and years and years, and you've been living it faithfully. And it's a privilege to be in a church with so many people who use their money so well and so wisely. It's fantastic. But if we haven't got this principle yet, if we're aware that we're doing a prodigal son kind of thing, or the early manager in the story kind of thing, where we've got God's stuff and we think it's ours, or we've got God's stuff and we're just using it in ways that are actually wasteful and are not good stewardship of it, we might want to think that through. Because how brilliant it's going to be to get to glory and to find that we have thousands of heavenly friends who are so grateful to us because of the way we have managed God's money that he's entrusted to us whilst we're on earth. I don't know about you, but that just gives me such pause for thought in the way I spend my money. Such pause for thought. So, for example, let's say this. Let's say you give some money to, I don't know, ICE, the Initiative for Christian Education, the Exeter Schools Work, that goes to funding the schools workers in our city, working alongside schools to see children hear about Jesus. Do you think it's possible that if you give money to ICE in glory, we may not see any of this before we die, but in heaven, we might get somebody thanking us because an ICE worker led them to the Lord Jesus Christ. And in part, it was your money that enabled that person to be employed. Or we get to glory and we find some Belarusian thanking us because they were converted through the friend who was converted whilst at university through a Christian union that was trained by the IFES worker that Belmont Chapel had in part supported. And we get thanked because of the money that we gave to the church that in part went to partly fund that worker. Or, yeah, I don't know, Friends International. We saw a Chinese student, Iris, baptized here a few weeks ago, who's now back in China, in mainland China. And what's it going to be like when we get to glory, when we see the fruit, not just of her conversion, but who knows what impact she's going to have through the rest of her life as a follower of the Lord Jesus Christ. She came to faith through the work of Friends International here in the city, which many of you give money to. In fact, if you give money to Belmont, you do give money to Friends International because the church centrally contributes to that task. Isn't that an amazing way to think about our money, that this parable teaches us that it can be used in those incredible ways? And as I was preparing this, I just couldn't get that scene from Schindler's List out of my head. And I was wary of showing it because it is such if you go on the web and Google that scene, some people find it a particularly hard scene to watch. So if you did, my apologies. But Schindler gets to that point where he says, this golden badge, 2 lives. That car, 10 lives. I wasted so much money. And we can't directly apply that principle to our lives. It's not that clear, is it? Money equals lives. But in terms of the eternal impact that our money can have, why would we waste it when if we steward it in these ways, God could just do something spectacular with it forever. I was talking to an American friend of mine recently who's not a particularly wealthy man. He's not here in Exeter, but he works elsewhere. And he's not a particularly wealthy man. And he's married to a woman with a job who is also not a particularly wealthy woman. And he staggered me by saying this. He wasn't boasting. We were just talking about money. And he just mentioned in passing that as a couple, their life goal is to give away $1 million. And I said, sorry? He said, yeah, we've planned our goal throughout our life together is to give away $1 million. And he's worked out that over, say, 50 years together, that's going to mean that they would need to give away, I think it's about $1,700 a month. And some of us in the room are thinking, that's impossible. What would that, I don't know what that would be in our exchange rate. £1,000 a month. Some of us in the room are thinking, there's no way I have £1,000 extra income. I just couldn't do it. And of course, that's fine. But for him, it was possible. He and his wife, it's just about possible. It's a stretch, but it's just about possible. But they've set that goal that says, how well can we actually steward the resources God is going to put in our lives throughout our lives? Can we put a target on it? Can we just try to be ambitious in the amount that we give away to see invested in heavenly treasure? 3 weeks ago, we took a harvest collection in both the morning service and the evening, and we raised £2,116.96. And you may remember that money is being split between the food bank in Exeter and the East Africa appeal, the DEC East Africa appeal. And I wonder whether when we give our money, we kind of pray our money home. Do you ever do that? We don't just give the money away, but we pray that, as we often do when we've taken a collection here, we pray that what the money has been given for is actually going to bring heavenly fruit. That mouths are going to be fed and stomachs are going to be filled, and that's great. But that as that work is done in the name of Jesus, spirits are going to be nourished. People are going to see Christ. They'll receive food that will last them forever, not just food that will last them in this lifetime, vital as that is. And Jesus gives us one more thing to think about. A disciple's future in heaven, he says, is going to be affected by how they've used their money on earth. And this is just a hint. But do you see? Jesus says that those who've been faithful managers of his money on earth will be entrusted with managing more of God's resources in the new heaven and the new earth. Just a hint. But you see verse 10, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. What does he mean? Well, I think he means the very little is the stuff that you get entrusted with on this earth, but in glory, there's going to be some other way in which we're entrusted with more of God's resource. And the degree to which we're entrusted with more in heaven on will depend on how well we've done here on earth. Or verse 11, whoever's dishonest, if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? Well, what does he mean by true riches? Does he mean that beyond the wealth we receive in this life, there's going to be another kind of riches that we might be entrusted with in glory? He talks about property of your own in verse 12. It's as if God is saying, we're being trialed on this earth with our management of God's trust fund, and if we do well here on earth with the stuff that God gives us now, boy, that's going to affect what we're entrusted with when we get to see him in heaven. It's just a hint, but again, I think it's a pretty exciting one. Now, brothers and sisters, what do we do with this? This principle, of course, doesn't just go for money. I think it goes for every good thing that God puts in our lives. It's true of time, it's true of friendship, it's true of family, it's true of all the possessions that God puts in our lives. We're stewards of them. So we might want to think about it more fully than just to do with money. But this parable is particularly about money, and we shouldn't dodge it. We've been looking at these life groups at Belmont over recent weeks and months, which are small accountability groups. And if you're in a life group, it might be that you would be brave enough just to ask one another a couple of questions about this passage if you're meeting this week or next week or sometime soon. How about asking one another these kinds of questions? How are we managing the trust fund that is actually our lives, stuff entrusted to us by God? Are we at least tithing? Tithing is when we give a tenth of our income to the church or to the church and other Christian agencies. How are we doing just with that basic level of giving, that kind of starter level that says, yeah, this is the kind of mark I lay in the sand that reminds me that everything I have is God's. And I remind myself of that by setting 10% of it aside, and I give it away to God's work. Are we at least doing that? Now, if you're not doing that, I think that's probably a problem. There may be great reasons why you're not, and we can't start legislating legalistically into one another's lives. But I think it would have to be a particularly good reason if you weren't able to do that or weren't willing to do that. But talk to your life group members or another Christian that you feel accountable to about that. What does your bank statement say about where your heart really is? If it's true that where a person's treasure is, there is their heart also, let's look at where their treasure is. What does it say about where our hearts are? If somebody went through my bank statements, what would it say about what I really actually cared about most? What would that say? Just a couple of questions that might be useful for you as we work through this in the days and weeks to come. Guy, can we take it back to the picture of the book? That one, thank you. If you want to press into this further, one of the best books on this is an oldie. It's by Peter Maiden. I checked, it's still available, and it's called Take My Plastic. And it's just a great way of Christians thinking through how they use their money for God's glory.